Hello and welcome to Scurvy Companions, the No Sweat Shakespeare podcast. My name is Emily, and today I'll be interviewing stage fright choreographer and master David Brimmer. Shakespeare wrote some of the most beautiful poetry and sweetest love scenes in history. But, as we all know, he also thought up some of the grisliest fight scenes and murders. How do you stage Macbeth and Macduff's duel, or Lavinia's maiming, or Mercutio's death? David Brimmer is here to shed some light on what those fights do for the story, and how actors get them on stage. David has been working in fight choreography for 40 years, and has staged fights for both Shakespearean and contemporary work for Broadway, film sets, and regional theaters across the United States. He is a renowned fight master with the Society of American Fight Directors, and founded the Stage Combat Program at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts. He has choreographed for scads of famous directors, actors, and playwrights. One of his recent credits was choreographing for Spring Awakening on Broadway. Today, David will talk with us about how he got started in stage combat, how the certification process for stage combat works, how to stage the reality of pain in stage fights, and why combat is meaningful in Shakespeare's works. So, without further ado, here is David. Hey there, David. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Em. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us a bit about sort of your role and your experience as a stage fighter, fight choreographer. You have so many titles. You're a professor as well. So just tell us a bit about all of the different things that you do.
Oh, wow. How much time do you have?
a bit, so.
Good. Well, yeah, it's kind of a jack of all trades. You work in this business. I started out training as an actor. Like you, I was at NYU. And I trained with Stella Adler, which was great. Yeah, yeah. And what got me into stage combat, I was a fencer. And as I've often told my students at NYU, 40 years and 150 pounds ago, I was a competitive fencer. True. So that's how I started. Wow. And a friend of mine and I were doing a scene for our class. And this is how long ago it was. I was playing Tybalt. He was playing Mercutio. And he said to me, look, you fence. Why don't you choreograph the fight?
Yeah.
So we did. We put it together and we're going at it. And at one point I lunged at him. And instead of retreating and parrying, he lunged at the same time.
Oh, no.
And the point of my sword caught him right on his occipital lobe.
Where is that for those who may not know?
That is right on the edge of your eye. That's the skull part that's underneath. And it clicked there and just sort of pulled his eye, the skin to the side and released. So he had a little scratch right next to his eye.
Oh, no.
And that's when I was like, okay, all right, we're going to cut that move. And he said, oh, he was apologizing to me because he knew he'd done the wrong move. He said, no, I'm sorry, I'll get it down. It's like, I'm sure you'll get it down. I'm never doing that move again.
No.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Had it been a quarter of an inch in the other direction, I might not be talking to you right now about this. I might not have gone into this field if I had put someone's eye out.
Yeah.
So, but that was the time I realized there's a hell of a lot more to doing this than just knowing how to fence. And as I say to my students, that's when I became a stage combat slut. I couldn't call myself a whore, yeah, because I wasn't charging for it, but I would work with anyone I could around the city. B.H. Barry, Jalen Suddeth, folks like that. Anytime I could sit in, assist, be a fly on the wall, that's what I did. And that's kind of how I got started with it. I realized when I'd be working with folks on some choreography, I'd see something, go, oh my goodness, we're going to have to look out for that. And the director might say, what are you talking about? It's like, well, right there. See that moment? What? Well, the blade just came really close to, oh my God, you're right. I didn't see that.
Yeah.
And that's when I started to realize, oh, I've got an eye for this. I'm seeing things that other people aren't seeing.
Yeah.
And then people started asking me to choreograph stuff, and then they started offering me money to do it.
A concept.
And that's kind of when I went, cha-ching, this is a lot better than just waiting tables.
Yeah.
And so that's what I started to do. It was a bit of a kind of a survival job, but it never felt like work. Oh, gosh, I've got to go and play with swords again today. You know, it was always a blast. And then I really enjoyed being on that side of the table, too.
Yeah.
I enjoyed being able to, you know, help the writer and director realize their vision, but also help the actors, give them the tools to keep them safe and allow them to do their job and tell the story and have the freedom within that form to then explore and tell the story. And that's kind of how it started. And then the same thing was true with teaching at NYU. That happened quite by accident. I had graduated and had been touring with one of my professors there. We toured through America and Europe at one point, doing the works of Nikolai Feregger and Meyerhold. You know, Russian constructivist theater. And I was talking to him one day and I said, you know, there's no stage combat at NYU. That's kind of ridiculous. And he's going, you're absolutely right. We should talk to Ron Argelander, who was the interim chair at that point. And here he is walking up the street towards us at just that moment. And he said, hey, Ron, you remember Dave? And I'm like, oh yeah, hi. And he's like, and I mentioned it to him. He's like, come to my office tomorrow. And that's how I then created the stage combat program at NYU.
Wow. Oh, what a story. Thank goodness you ran into him. So you created the stage combat program at NYU, which is incredible. And you teach there now. Where else have you taught and do you teach?
I have taught. Currently, I occasionally teach at the Terry Knickerbocker Studio out in Brooklyn. I teach with a classical studio at NYU.
Yeah.
I've taught at the Atlantic Theater Company, their program.
Mm-hmm.
I've taught at Strasbourg. I've taught at Stella Adler. I've taught at Yale. Yes, I guest taught at RADA.
Insane, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London.
Yes. Wow. And that was, I love saying that because it happened. I was visiting my friend Richard Ryan over there, who was teaching at RADA at the time. He was the choreographer on Troy and Sherlock Holmes and Batman. And he's currently the swordmaster on the series Vikings. But anyway, he had me over. I was visiting, and I was going to adjudicate his students at RADA. And I showed up because some of my students from NYU were currently over there in class. He was giggling, saying, oh, this will be great. You know, you can come in, and, you know, they'll see you, and that'll be funny for them and all that. Well, I show up, and when we get there, he goes, oh, my God, I just realized I've got to be on set today. And Brett's also his assistant, you know, who was working there, is also not. You're going to have to teach this class. So, quite by accident, it's like, I'm glad I'm here. I can cover for you. I walked in and taught a couple of classes for him. And I was able to tell my students who are over there, yes, you traveled, 1,000 miles, only to take another class from me.
Oh, but that's fantastic. And so when you say adjudicate, what do you mean by that? Tell us a bit about how the program works at both at NYU and, you know, at the schools that have a certification process for stage combat.
Certainly. I am a fight master with the Society of American Fight Directors.
Mm-hmm. What is a fight master? How do you get to that?
Oh, boy. Well, now we can go down that rabbit hole, too.
Fair. Okay. We'll start with that, and then we'll move on to the students.
Okay. So the Society of American Fight Directors was first started back in 1988 by David Boucher and Eric Fredrickson. So they had certified with the British Society of Fight Directors.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had been bringing over a teacher from there, Henry Marshall, Wonderful man, very, you know, old school. We're talking, you know, those folks in terms of lineage. So he would come over and adjudicate, and basically Henry basically said to them, hey, you know, why don't you start your own society here in America?
Yeah, and they went, sense.
Oh, we could have had a V8. Yeah, great idea. So they founded the society based on the British Society, and began teaching classes and going through the same process. What there are there at present, there are 8 different weapon disciplines that you can study. And within that, there are certain specific required moves that one would expect to have to do within these particular styles. For instance, if we're talking about broadsword or longsword, yeah, there are certain cuts and parries that you have to know, avoidances, certain footwork you have to do. You have to be able to demonstrate the ability to play a wound, play a kill, that kind of stuff. And so here are the moves you have to do, often sometimes per combatant, sometimes per fight. And then you would perform those moves in a choreographed fight with a scene, because it's stage combat. We have to see that you can walk and chew gum. So can you talk and swing a sword or wield a staff or a sword and shield, whatever it is, and do these specific moves. So that's what it means to be adjudicated. So I will come in and look at the students and go like, okay, how proficient are they? Are they safe? Number one, are they safe? That's the first thing that we have to see. Are they partnering well? Because that's what it's all about. You know, and I'll say it now and probably say it several times through the podcast. Number one rule of stage combat, take care of your partner. That means I'm going to make sure that they are safe. That means I'm going to support them in their acting. I'm going to make them look good if that's my job or whatever's needed and required for the scene. But that's the number one rule. So I'm watching their partnering. That's what I'm really looking for when I'm seeing it. And of course, then you break it down into targeting, stance, balance, movement. How are their advances, retreats, passes, all of that stuff, lunging. Yeah, all of the things that we're looking at there. If they also can really knock it out of the park, if they're doing this, and I sometimes will say, you know, I wasn't even taking notes. I was watching this scene unfold in front of me. If the acting's that good, then you can pass with a recommendation, meaning I could recommend you to someone to do this work. So you can get a basic pass or you can get a recommended pass. And believe me, a basic pass is hard enough to get.
Right, of course.
That's the first thing. But if you manage to really be able to perform while doing it and really sell that fight, then yeah, I can recommend you, which is often good if, you know, someone is looking, you're going to a Shakespeare festival over the summer, something like that, and I see that you've recommended in several weapons, I might consider you then to be the fight captain for these shows.
Right. And what's a fight captain?
Oh, fight captain is just like a dance captain on a show. So I'll choreograph it, and this person, I will, I often tend to bring my own assistants in, but I will often work with this person who's a member of the cast to help choreograph, and they then know all of the choreography. They will be responsible for it when I leave the show, once it's up and running. They will be running fight calls every night. So before a performance every night, you walk through the fights. So you make sure you have them down. You don't have to perform them full speed, but you go, okay, this is where we're doing. This is where we are on stage, just to get in sync with your partner before the show. And the fight captain is responsible for running those with the stage manager and works very much in concert with the stage manager to keep the fights clean if it's an extended run, which we hope, of course, it will be. You know, we're going 6 months, maybe a year. Wow, that's fantastic. Or we're going to be on tour for 6 months. Well, yeah, you've got to keep those fights clean and safe and all of that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, though you may not rehearse every night the play, you do have to rehearse the fights every night to make sure that everybody is safe. So that's really interesting info. So moving on to, you know, how you became a fight master, how long did that take you?
It's not a linear kind of thing, really.
Okay, sure.
So I would say, boy, I've been doing this, you know, I started fencing in the early, mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. I started teaching at NYU in 1985, 86, mm-hmm. somewhere in there. It's so long ago, I can't remember. But I started doing that. I didn't become a certified teacher with the SAFD until I think it was 1990.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I became a certified teacher. And then the next step was to become a fight director. And
right.
So I became a fight director, I guess, around the turn of the millennium, a little bit before that.
Mm-hmm.
But we are the Society of American Fight Directors. And so that's kind of the highest rank you can achieve. I'm a fight director.
Right.
The College of Fight Masters is an advisory board.
Okay.
And the way you get into that is you're invited into the college.
Ooh.
And you have to then submit it's the labors of Hercules, let's face it. You have to supply all your CV, your letter, your philosophy on this work, all of that, and samples of your work. You have to bring 3 fight masters in to interview you and also to witness your work, to see a live performance of your work is generally how that goes. So it's quite a process, and it's not a guarantee that you'll get in once you've done that. At the time when I was brought up for it, it needed to be a unanimous vote to get in.
Wow.
So it was a very, you know, tightly held kind of point at that. So it is an honor to have been voted in that way. And it is a service position. Our job is to serve the society, helping with the governing body, being ambassadors out in the professional world, mentoring folks moving up who are interested in this art form, serving as teachers on the national workshop level and regional workshops, and adjudicating fight tests.
Yeah.
It's also one of the things we do. So yeah, it's a responsibility.
It's a lot of responsibilities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also a joy too, you know?
Oh, of course. Yeah. And then moving back, I just had a question about when you were saying that, you know, you can get a recommended pass if you really make the fight believable, if you really act it. I know that you focus a lot of your philosophy on using the reality of pain in teaching stage combat. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means?
Oh, sure. For me, I've often seen fights where there are no consequences to the violence.
Mm.
You know, someone's fighting along, they get cut on the arm, ow, and then they just keep fighting. It's like, but your arm was just, wait a minute. so to me, we're starting to trail into philosophy here. For me, why do we do this work? What is this work for? Okay, why did the playwright put this into their text? So for me, I always use the example of Shakespeare. Shakespeare was, whoever they were, was brilliant. He knew people loved fights. People enjoyed watching them, right? And we know that's why we're talking right now. People enjoy watching fights.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
All of his histories, all of his tragedies, and a lot of his comedies will climax in a fight.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew it put butts on benches. He could sell tickets. But also, he's making a point. Romeo and Juliet doesn't have a happy ending.
Right.
These characters that you've fallen in love with are dead by the end of the play because they decided to cross swords, because they decided to do this. So in his tragedies, he makes the point that, you know, that moment in Romeo and Juliet, if Mercutio had just let Tybalt walk away,
right,
instead of shouting, "Tybalt, you rat catcher," I've staged that sometimes where Tybalt has literally walked off into the wings and Mercutio has to call him back on stage. If he just let him go, everything would, then that's what happens in Romeo and Juliet. At every step, the character just makes that one decision. If you just not had done that at all, everything would have been. But it doesn't happen. That's why it's so tragic. That's why the Victorians actually had to rewrite the ending.
Yeah.
It was too much for them, so they had to make it a happy ending. And that's not what Shakespeare's point was.
No,
his point that he's making is when you result to violence, this is what happens. People die. People suffer. That's what the playwright is trying to get across in this. To an audience that was very used to this type of violence.
Yeah.
You know, they saw sword fights in the streets every day. So they knew what this was about. You know, I love to do that with talking about his histories. He does the same thing. I mean, this is the man who came up with the term cannon fodder.
Mm-hmm.
That's Shakespeare. All right. So you have Falstaff. I talk to my students about if you know the play Henry IV, Part One, The Battle of Shrewsbury. And I ask my students, who's the first character that dies in the Battle of Shrewsbury? It's Sir Walter Blunt. Now, there are more lines spoken about Sir Walter Blunt than he actually has lines. And that's done on purpose because Shakespeare didn't want him talking too much because the idea is Sir Walter Blunt is the best of the best. Yeah. And everyone talking about Sir Walter Blunt goes, oh, the flower of English knighthood, the best we have, right? Mm. He's dressed as the king. The Douglas comes in, says, are you the king? I've killed six of you already.
Right.
And he says, yes, I'm the king, and the Douglas kills him. And that's a statement on, yes, the best first to die in the battle, right? War makes no exception. So our best people are dead. Who eulogizes Sir Walter Blunt? Falstaff, who comes on and says, I like not this grinning honor Sir Walter hath. And what is honor anyway? Air. So he gets to make his statement about this is what honor gets you. It gets you dead. It's nothing.
Right.
It's nothing. It's all hot air.
Yeah.
You know, and the same thing when Falstaff is, you know, getting recruits. And you see this tall gang. This is in part two. You see this tall, gangly, you know, tailor who's thin as a rail. Yeah, this frail old guy. And then you have Bulgaff, who was huge and strong. And Bulkaff slips a little money to Falstaff. He's like, oh, yeah, you can let him go. And Shallow says, what, you're losing your best man. And he goes, food for cannon. Doesn't matter. They don't have to be good. Yeah. They're all going to be dead anyway.
Yeah.
You know? And that's the point he's making. And this was 400 years ago, Shakespeare's talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so it's also, you know, very appropriate today. So that's what I'm trying to fulfill what the author is, their idea is coming forth here. And to me, to make it read to an audience, I want the human element of it.
Yeah.
And so there are consequences. If you're hurt, you're hurt. It's going to change the way you move. I'm especially working with students on their breath and actors on using their breath to also tell the story. How are you breathing differently? Well, you know, you've taken the class. I have a pain exercise.
Yeah.
And I tell students, you know, okay, well, just think of something like ever stub your toe or hit your thumb with a hammer. Or I'll say, you know, this is the one that usually gets folks. Ever close your hand in a car door?
Ow.
And that's the one that's, what we're looking for. I want you to take that and I'll clap my hands and that's the moment of impact. Hammer to thumb, bowling ball to toe, car door to fingers, and act it out. And then that's what we're looking at. We're looking at what happens during that, you know? So,
and you do go to the breath, you go,
yeah, you're going to be breathing differently. I guarantee before you struck your thumb with a hammer than you are afterwards.
Right.
And the way you breathe organically hits the audience on that gut level. That's our job. Yes, the writing will engage them intellectually. Our job is to engage them on a physical level and a gut level. Mm. I want them wincing when they see this. When they see something happening.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to someone going, oh, look at that. That was a lovely little prix de fer and a glissade.
Right.
It's like, well, then it's not working. If they're not writhing in their seats, I'm not doing my job. And, you know, for me, it's also, I consider what I do a bit of a calling. I'm a Quaker. And so for me, this is the place to examine the violent side of human nature safely.
Yeah.
We can expose this side to an audience. They can experience it. If we can take them on that roller coaster through the show where they're experiencing all these things that the actors are experiencing, hopefully we can end up at the end of the show with what the Greeks call catharsis.
Mm-hmm.
They will have experienced this and on a more transformative level get the ideas we're talking about. Otherwise, they could just read a book going, oh, yeah, fighting bad. Oh, yeah, killing people's bad. Yeah, got it.
Right.
But when you're seeing it, when you're, yes, thank you, that's the perfect word. Mm-hmm. When you're engaged on that visceral level, it hits you on a deeper level.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of Shakespeare, tell us a bit about the work that you've done with Shakespeare. So obviously, you choreograph for a huge range of productions, from very contemporary, you know, Broadway productions to, you know, you work with the classical studio at NYU doing Shakespeare. What do you find the difference is in choreographing for Shakespeare versus contemporary theater?
There are some differences, but really the basis is still the same.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, the basics, it's right there. Interesting, I was on a film set a few days ago. We're talking about this, and I was talking about a production that the director had been on back in the 80s. And he was saying that this star, you know, actually would hit him in the head every night with a rubber bowling pin.
Oh, no, thank you.
No, thank you. But it hit him, you know, sometimes pretty hard. In fact, one time split his skull open and he was bleeding.
Oh, no.
And that incenses me. Now, you have to remember, this was the 80s. This was that period of, oh, method acting. Oh, it's it's got to be really real. Yeah, make it real. And, you know, as I was telling you, I trained with Stella Adler, one of the major practitioners and creators of method acting. And she said to me one time, David, if people wanted to see reality, they'd ride the subway. She said, they go to the theater to see the truth. So I tell people, we are going for the truth of the violence, not the reality of the violence. And sometimes in order to create that truth, we're doing very artificial things, but looking at it from the proscenium stage or whatever viewing we have, it looks realistic to them. It is truthful. Even though I'm missing your face by a mile with this slap, you're making the sound of the slap, you know, all of this stuff, all of these things, as you know, going into doing these techniques, there's nothing natural or realistic about them. But when viewed, you get the audience going, and very different than reality on stage. Everything's, oh, it'll look so much better if it's real. No. I've seen people wanting to work real punches. And I've had people saying, oh, it looks so fake. Mm. One of the biggest ones was one time where during a broadsword fight, the choreography was stomach cut and the character was supposed to jump back, and then a head cut and the character was supposed to duck. Well, the person who was supposed to be doing that action reversed them. And so as this guy was coming in with the stomach cut, he ducked. Now, the guy swinging the broadsword checked his blow, But the blade was a little heavy, so his wrist just broke. 4-inch gash across the guy's forehead.
Oh, no!
Pouring blood down his face.
Oh,
now, boy. Three things that I heard in the audience. Oh, that is the fakest looking blood I've ever seen.
Really?
That I could make better blood than that. That looks like red paint. And I tell this to my students to tell them, reality doesn't work on stage. Here's a guy who literally had his head split open by a broadsword. And the audience is saying it's the fakest looking thing I've ever seen. The reason being, the blood was bright red. It was arterial blood. We're used to seeing venal blood, which is a nice dark maroon color. But you cut deep enough and it's bright red. Oh, that looks so painted. Look fake. It looks like red paint. Yeah. So.
Wow.
Yes. So reality really doesn't work on stage. Also, if the audience is concerned about the actor's safety, we failed.
Yep.
If they're worried about the actor and not concerned about the character, we've not done our job.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah. We want to keep them in the story, not take them out of the story.
Right.
Otherwise, cut the fight. It's not serving the text.
That makes sense. Well, we don't have too much time, but before we go, I did want to talk to you just so that, you know, people can get a sense of what exactly you've done. Can you tell us about some of your favorite projects that you've done, some of your favorite people that you've worked with throughout your incredibly prolific career?
Oh, boy. Now I'd like to have a lot more time. I mean, I think, of course, one of my favorite people to work with was Patrick Stewart.
Oh, my goodness. What was that on?
That was, I worked with him on A Life in the Theater. Just a wonderful production. And he's just as wonderful as, I would say even more wonderful than you'd imagine him to be. Just a total class act.
That's wonderful to hear.
Yeah, he's because I think a lot of English actors are that way. It's a smaller community over there, and there's a real sense of lineage and heritage there in this, and that we've all done the same thing. You know, he's now a star, but I started out as a spear carrier. I know what that was like. And there's this concept of we're all actors, we're all in this company, we're all here to make this work.
Yeah.
And so, yes, just a wonderful class act. And then several other folks that I've had a great time working with. Paul Rudd was wonderful. Yeah, they're just some great folks. Raul Esparza, Liz Ruff. There's just a number of wonderful people that I've been blessed to get to work with. But also writers. It's been one of my great pleasures to work with a lot of living playwrights. Much as I love Shakespeare, it's great to collaborate with the writer themselves. And I'm, you know, we're talking about Shakespeare. I'm kind of known as the gritty, realistic guy. So, for instance, I'm working with Tracy Letts, doing Killer Joe and Bug, working with Marty McDonough on Lieutenant of Inishmore and Cripple of Inishman, and just last year, Hangman. Right before we closed, we did about 13 previews at the Golden before everything shut down last spring. But just, and another thing that's been great right now is I've had the opportunity of working with a lot of young women playwrights and playwrights of color, which has been great. Yeah. Brandon Jacob Jenkins, Susan Laurie Parks. Right now, looking at bringing Antoinette Nwandu's Passover to Broadway. It looks like we're going to be doing that this summer.
That's so exciting.
But that, to me, is just so much fun to get these up-and-coming voices out there. And it's something I'm trying to do with our part of the business, because it's a lot of old white guys right now. And so I've always, as you know, I've always had an open door policy that anyone who wants to study, I'll mentor them. But I've realized right now with BIPOC people that in some respects, I need to actually try to recruit. Because, you know, my open door policy is like, sure, anyone who wants to come in. But realizing they see just old white guys doing this. So the idea that this could be a career path doesn't necessarily cross their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And so if someone's really good, I will say, hey, if you're interested in this, I'd be happy to continue working with you. So that's where I am right now. I really want to open up the industry, and we're working to do that on many levels. And I think it's our job right now. You know, I'm getting older, but it's to really to this. I'm so excited at what's happening right now in the theater, all across the board. People are calling out the abuse that's been going on.
Yes.
You know, something that was just taken for granted before the turn of the millennium. It was just understood. Oh, this is what it is. People aren't putting up with it anymore. So I think we're at a wonderful pivotal moment in the theater and in society. And it's time to step up and really dive into that.
Oh, thank you. That is fantastic to hear that you're doing that work. And I think a fantastic note for us to leave off on. So do you have anything else that you'd like to share with us before we go?
Oh, I'll just be holding you all in the light. Take care of yourselves and, you know, remember to be kind.
Yes. Thank you so, so much for coming on our podcast. It was fantastic to get to talk to you. It was such a wonderful perspective.
It's so good to hear from you again. It's great.
Thank you. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Scurvy Companions, the No Sweat Shakespeare podcast. If you're interested in learning more, check out our site at nosweatshakespeare.com and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We look forward to talking Shakespeare with you again soon.